Hey, everybody. Did you like how I just did my own theme song just there? I hope you did. Jay here with a quick interruption. I don't have ads, so I'm going to advertise myself in the middle of this podcast. Why not? This is somewhere north of 300 episodes when you're listening to this. And golly gee, it has been a journey, and I appreciate you coming with me on that journey for this whole time that you've been here. Maybe you've been here from the beginning. Maybe you've been here since like an episode ago. I'm just glad you're here. But I do have to say this. We here at Blockbusting, and there's literally a we. Chorkin, come around. Come around to the other side of the camera so we can see. Look, guys, I got a staff now, all right? I got interns, okay? I got producers. I got stuff to handle here at the space that I record at and elsewhere. And I want to be able to pay these people. And I, unfortunately, do not make the kind of money to pay these people myself. And that's where I hope that you can come in. By supporting the Blockbusting Patreon. Yes, that's right. We've got a Patreon. I haven't plugged it in a bit, but I'm going to start plugging it heavy now, because why not? I want to pay these folks, all right? And you can support the podcast for just as low as a dollar a month, all right? Dollar a month goes back into the show. I'm not even paying myself. I don't care about paying myself for this podcast. I care about giving a little something back to the people who help me out, because I'm getting a lot of help from people these days, and they deserve a little something for their efforts beyond just my eternal thanks and gratitude, which they're going to get anyway. So you can subscribe for a dollar a month. You start getting access to bonus content from me. Like I'm posting episodes of my game show Wrong that I'm doing here in Los Angeles that I'm not posting to the public. I'll start posting bonus episodes of me talking about stuff again. What's Good with Jay Light, where I just talk about what I liked that I saw on the television and the internet and stuff these days, because that's how you do for Patreon. We still have the J-Flix level, the $5 tier, where you can get access to my full film, television, comedy special library. That's just $5 a month. It's cheaper than pretty much every streaming service out there, except for, I guess, Apple TV is $5 a month. And they have Severance and Ted Lasso, so you really can't go wrong there. And they got Coda. I mean, Coda, what a delight. But you know what I've got? Xanadu. And nobody else has that. Duh. I've got A Day Without a Mexican, Los Digits' least favorite movie. You listen to that episode, it's a great episode. But you've got to watch the movie, which I have on JFlix for $5 a month. I got a bunch of weird stuff. So go consider, please, subscribing to the Patreon for Blockbusting. The link is in the show notes. Or you can just go type into your little web browser right now, tippity-tap it into patreon.com/blockbusting. Again, that is patreon.com/blockbusting. And your support will go to helping me throw a little cash the way of the fine folks who help make this podcast happen. That's all I'm asking, is you throw me a little something so I can throw them a little something, okay? We're going direct, because, you know, this is like thoughts and prayers with guns. Like, saying thanks is only going to do so much. I want to give them cash. Okay, at least buy them a coffee or something. Patreon.com/blockbusting. You can join and support for as little as a dollar a month. And that's all there is, folks. Enjoy the rest of the episode. Oh, let me tell you something. Busting makes me feel good. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Blockbusting, the podcast where we love to hate movies. I'm your host, Jay Light. Joining me once again, a rare two-time appearance from my friend, and podcast producer, Ben Rosen.
It's so great to be back. It's so great to be back. I've been looking forward to a return. And as I was writing my notes, as we were talking about this movie, I realized that the last episode I did was Gran Torino.
That's right.
A boomer catnip movie, as we described on that episode. An episode that I absolutely love doing. I feel like I accidentally picked a very similar kind of movie. It's not, it's definitely not a drama. It has nothing else in common with Gran Torino.
Not even close to awards bait by any means.
No, but in terms of like who wrote it and some of the ideas that are in there somewhere, I feel like this is also like old guy yelling at clouds kind of thing, right? Disappointed with where culture has come, what society is like now, right?
A little bit. I mean, you literally, if we're using old guy yelling as old guy writing, then that's exactly what this movie is. Phone Booth, 2002 American psychological thriller directed by Joel Schumacher, who really, I don't think, did anything wrong in this movie, as egregiously as Larry Cohen, the writer of the movie. It also stars Colin Farrell, Forrest Whitaker, Katie Holmes, Radha Mitchell, and Kiefer Sutherland. It's about a malevolent hidden sniper who calls a phone booth. When a young publicist inside answers the phone, he quickly finds his life is at risk.
That's not a great description, though, is it? It's not when he answers the phone. Like, he's intentionally there. So much of this, what... I texted, I was like, so many notes that I wrote were just questions of, yeah, like, why does this happen? Why does this happen? It's all so convenient. Like, the way you describe it, it sounds like it's supposed to be wrong place, wrong time. This could happen to anybody. But that's not the plot that we get. Like, he's there every day at the same time to call this Katie Holmes character because he's married and he doesn't want the calls to show up on his cell phone, so he's using a payphone. Uh-huh. And, like, I guess the caller, as they call him, has been, like, stalking him and thinks that this, like, I don't even want to say he's cheating on his wife. He's not. Like, he's you know, at least not physically, and perhaps not even emotionally, because, like, the call that he has with Katie Holmes is devoid of emotion, right, or intimacy in any way.
For a movie that is R-rated, the call is about as PG as it gets.
Well, he takes off his ring as if they're going to, like, engage in some kind of, like, flirtatious banter or, like, I don't know, some kind of, like, yeah, sexual conversation, and there's just none of that.
So
anyway, like, I don't know why he's the guy who's in this phone booth getting targeted.
We should make something clear, which is the premise of why he has been targeted is because this sniper is targeting other bad people. But one of them is has made child pornography, and the other one committed some pretty egregious financial crimes. And we've gone from, like, two really heinous offenses to, he talks to a lady who's not his wife on the phone, and maybe wants to maybe wants to stick it in a hotel. Where's the leap? Kiefer,
yeah.
How'd you get to this point?
Yeah, very, very confusing. I also, I went back, because I watched this movie back in, like, April of this year. And I remembered that at the time, because my buddy and I, who co-host our show, American Scene, which has been on a very long hiatus, but I hope anybody who's listening will go check that out. We did another early Colin Farrell movie called American Outlaws. And we were like, wow, Colin Farrell, like, early 2000s, not a great run of movies, but super, super charming performances, regardless of what he's in. He's definitely a compelling actor. And so I wanted to watch this movie, also knew that it had gotten pretty good reviews. And I remember texting my buddy, hey, by the way, I watched Phone Booth last night, and just rattled off a whole bunch of notes. So I just wanted to read through some of those.
Please.
I still somehow fell asleep in the last 3 minutes, even though it's an 80-minute movie. I think the purple shirt is the most regrettable choice in the film. It's pretty bad. It's pretty bad. The mystery of what has this guy done is pretty silly, because he hasn't really done anything worth dying for, as we've been talking about.
Yeah, not really.
He's obnoxious, that's for sure, so it's not like wrong place, wrong time, or whatever. And Kiefer isn't, like, this was my assumption that the movie was going to be about, and it wasn't this. Kiefer isn't, like, using him to do stuff on the ground, like an eagle eye scenario. Like, that's what I thought he was going to be, like, control. Like, you're in the phone booth. I've got you on. I'm going to kill you if you don't do these certain things.
Right.
He's just like, I'm going to kill you at some point.
Just to toy with you.
Yeah. And then he's like, but I'm not even going to kill you. I'm going to make the cops do it. Like, there's that one moment in it. But it's like, what are you waiting for? Like, he didn't toy with the other two guys. So, like, what's the point of all of this?
Yeah. This movie is supposed to be, I mean, it's listed as a thriller, a psychological thriller. That's what Wikipedia calls it. I'm sure that's what IMDb probably calls it. I'm sure that's what all the critics who gave this somehow a 72% on Rotten Tomatoes call it. I'm sure that all the people who saw this movie and made it almost $100 million at the box office also called it that. And yet the only thing that really happens in this movie is Colin Farrell is nervous.
Yeah.
Just a guy nervous in a phone booth who clearly I don't think ever actually, it doesn't ever seem like his life is really in danger. It feels like there are not the level of stakes that we are being told in the dialogue exist.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. There's one point that felt so disingenuous to me where Kiefer Sutherland is saying, I have a 30 caliber bolt action, whatever kind of rifle up here. Exit wound's going to be the size of a tangerine. And then the guy, the pimp,
Leon.
He gets shot.
Yes.
Leon.
Yeah.
Leon gets shot. He reacts initially like he got bit by a mosquito.
Yes.
And there's no exit wound.
Nope.
And then he just dies on the ground. And you're like, what? How did this happen?
I have so many notes about Leon and all of the sex workers and all of that whole thing is so hilariously bad to me.
It's so bad.
Yes, like, first of all, they were, like, berating him for 5 to 10 minutes and never saw a gun. So the fact that he is now, that this pimp is now shot from behind when Colin Farrell was in front of him, a wound, first of all, yeah, not the size of a tangerine like Kiefer said it would be, but also the wound from a handgun shot at that close distance would look entirely different. Even if he did somehow, like, reach around behind him and shoot him in the back from being in front of him, which he never was,
no.
It just doesn't... And then, gosh. Mm-hmm. And then Leon dies, and then the sex workers are still there, and, like, the cops are treating them like very trustworthy witnesses, which would never happen
in
real life. It's the one time that any cop believed a sex worker is in this movie.
This is absolutely crazy. Out of all the movies where you have progressive treatment of sex workers by the police, you didn't shoot your shot correct.
Yeah.
Pun not entirely intended.
And then even at the the ending just, oh my God. So I have so many, yes. I feel like I'm all over the place because it's just like one thing after another of convenience after convenience of just the script answering the plot holes or trying to, like, paper over the things that don't make any sense. Mm-hmm. So, like, so when Kiefer's on the phone with Pam, the Katie Holmes character,
yes.
When he's like, this guy's been calling you, but, you know, he's married, and didn't you know he's married, and he's just hoping to, like, get you into a hotel, and Pam's like, well, he said he uses the phone because it's quiet. And I'm like, in what fucking world is a payphone on the middle
in the middle of Manhattan, New York City? Yeah.
How is that quiet? Why does he take his wedding ring off to make a phone call? Like, why does he answer the phone when it rings after he hangs up with Pam the first time? Like, he just answers it and is just like, hello?
It doesn't,
like,
make sense.
He's still here. Like, yeah, he's busy. And he just stands around there and there's, like, cars going by and stuff. And then the phone rings and he picks it up. And it's not like, oh, hey, Pam, you know, I'm sorry about what I just said. Like, thinking that it was Pam calling back. He just answers it because it's ringing.
So
that doesn't make any sense. It's like, why is he using the payphone if he's trying to cover up his phone records? Just call her from his office.
And then, like,
be quiet there.
I also feel like there's a part of me that's, I don't think this guy has an office. I feel like he's just on the go 24/7. And that's why he's tricking an intern into carrying five different burner cell phones, which also, that doesn't make a ton of sense. That's going to, this is back when cell phone plans were exorbitantly expensive. Why would you have five phones on one line?
He does seem like he can afford it. He does seem like he can afford it because he's got the Italian suits and this whole thing, and it's like all about image and whatever else, and he's interacting with like the next hot white rapper.
Shout out to Ben Foster as Big Q.
Ben Foster?
That was.
Oh my God.
That was indeed Ben Foster.
And I thought my love for, my undying love for Ben Foster would never go away, but... he had to show up in this movie. So
he did.
I like him a little less now.
There are. Yeah. I feel like, I mean, like I said, there are elements of this movie that I feel like still, I don't even know why I'm saying still, as if this wasn't the first time I watched this movie and literally finished it about 20 minutes ago. There are parts of this movie that I do think kind of work. And I feel like all of that goes to the director. I think Joel Schumacher did as competent of a job directing this as he's going to do. And I did appreciate a little bit of Kiefer Sutherland's performance. Colin Farrell, I usually like, but I don't think that in this he's doing anything novel. He's doing anything interesting. Same with Forrest Whitaker. They're both just kind of playing the guy who the screenwriter has set them up to be, which is put upon cop and guy who is kind of shitty but has a heart of gold in the end, I guess.
Yeah. Forrest Whitaker totally wasted here.
I was excited when he showed up. I thought something. I was like, oh, this is going to take a nice direction.
He's very dumb. He's a very dumb cop. Mm-hmm. He's there for whatever, like this whole hostage situation, I guess, is like, I don't even know why they have so many cops show up to this thing. Like, it feels like overkill for a guy who's just in a phone booth and like hasn't been identified to have a gun or anything. He's not threatening anybody. He's just standing there. So like that whole and then he doesn't wait for the negotiator to show up when if he could have just waited 10 minutes. Like, there's no reason why he had to make contact right away. The guy's not fucking going anywhere. He's inside a phone booth. Like, so there's that. And then it takes him, like, as soon as I noticed this on my second time watching it, as soon as Kelly shows up, this is Colin Farrell's wife, so she's seen the news. He's all over the news.
Right.
Major story. As soon as Kelly shows up, she's like, yeah, this guy called my store and then said, like, something would be happening with Stu. Doesn't do anything with that information until like 40 minutes later when he's like, oh, right, the guy who called the store, we should trace that phone call because they've been having trouble tracing the call from inside the phone booth. It's like, yeah, she already gave you that information.
Yeah, why didn't she just do that?
40 minutes ago. It feels like you're saying, like, there's not a lot that actually happens because they're just trying to fill the runtime with other stuff that could just delay the inevitable.
Yeah. There's so much that it feels like is left on the table in terms of ratcheting up the stakes of making us as an audience care about what's happening in this movie. Instead, we get a very paint-by-numbers-y kind of, you know, series of events that happens where it's like, all right, the wife shows up, then the girlfriend shows up, and then he gets shot. He gets out of the phone booth, but he's not actually dead because it was he got shot by a beanbag from the shotgun. And oh no, we think it was the pizza guy, but it actually wasn't the pizza guy. It was Kiefer Sutherland all along.
Yeah, shocker that it wasn't the pizza guy. Like, does Colin Farrell, like, can he not recognize people's voices? Like, the guy spoke,
I guess,
many,
not.
Like, they had a conversation, and then this guy with a completely other voice calls, like, immediately after. Like, there's no way, like, that guy would have had to hustle up all those stairs, like, you know, get blocks away, set up the rifle. Like, he would have had to do so much for it to be that same guy. It doesn't make any sense.
Even setting up the fake outs that happen in the movie, like, there's that one part where Colin Farrell is talking to Kiefer Sutherland. Kiefer Sutherland mentions something like Vietnam. He's like, this is just like Nam. And Colin Farrell's like, oh, were you in Vietnam? And then the guy, he starts talking about stuff that happened in Vietnam during the war. And Colin Farrell's like, you know, we could tell your story. And I appreciated this part where he's like, okay, yeah, we'll try and flip it. He's turning on his publicist brain. And then the guy, our caller, Kiefer Sutherland, goes, I would have to be at least 50 years old to have fought in that war, you idiot, and yells at him. He sounds like he could be 50.
He could conceivably be 50. Yeah, I didn't. And then what's so funny is later, Kelly says he sounded like he was mid 30s. How does somebody sound like they're mid 30s?
Does somebody sound like they're in their mid 30s?
I sound like I'm 15. So like,
I sounded like I was in my mid 30s when I was 15. Everybody,
that's lucky.
It was lucky, but also voices don't matter unless you are super old. Like, that's the only way that you can tell. If somebody's talking like this, you guarantee that they're going to be like in their 70s.
My grandmother's 104 and has sounded the same for the past 30 years, as long as I can remember. You know, my dad is what, in his mid 60s. And same thing, like has sounded the same as long as I can remember. So yeah. I don't get it. Like,
it's not solving anything. It's not giving us anything. And it just makes me watch the movie and go, why did you decide to make this choice? Why did you write this line of dialogue? And it truly is, at the end of the day, I think it is just to fill the runtime, which is a shame because this movie, it could have been more compelling than it was. I mean, it was crazy to me to find out. So Larry Cohen, the screenwriter, he has been in the industry for a very, very, very long time. He has been working since the 60s.
1958.
Yes. Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah. He wrote, he created the TV series, The Invaders. He scripted episodes of The Defenders and The Fugitive.
And then Maniac Cop. Maniac Cop was his like trilogy. He had three of those movies. Starting in 1988 with what's his name from Evil Dead?
Yeah. What's the guy's name?
I was literally just watching the trailer. Bruce Campbell.
Bruce Campbell, thank you. He wrote the sequel to The Magnificent Seven. This guy, he's been around and he's been making procedurals for literally his entire life. And he eventually starts to make some horror movies, and then he kind of evolves a little bit into this, iteration of his career, where he has decided, you know what? I'm going to take this idea that I pitched to Alfred Hitchcock in the 60s that we couldn't figure out how to make and go, oh, we can make it now. Let's make it happen. Let's get it going. They pitched this movie to Tom Cruise, Will Smith, Mel Gibson, Robin Williams, Anthony Hopkins, Nicolas Cage.
Ooh, I mean, you know I'd sign up for the Nicolas Cage version of this movie in a heartbeat.
Now, here's the question, though. Who do you think they would try to get Nicolas Cage to be? Do you think they got him to be Colin Farrell or The Caller?
What if this is an adaptation of the Three scenario where they wanted him to be The Caller, the wife, and Colin Farrell, they're all him, you know, that kind of thing. That would be amazing. Adaptation also 2002, funny enough.
That would be fun. Also, I would watch the Anthony Hopkins version of this where Anthony Hopkins is the caller and Kiefer Sutherland's in the booth.
Well, I would have watched the Alfred Hitchcock version of this movie. Like, the stuff in the movie that doesn't work in 2002 is stuff that would work in like the 50s or 60s, you know, guy upstanding or you know, member of society is having some kind of affair with his with some woman, always calling from a particular phone booth at a particular time, mm-hmm. and gets harassed by some sniper looking over him. Like, that feels very effective in that prime Alfred Hitchcock era.
Yes.
The stuff that I felt could have worked better in the 2002 version is the idea that like phone booths are disappearing. So why does somebody go into one of those? And also in like a post 9/11 New York scenario, the idea that like there's something mysterious and somebody like pulling the strings from somewhere else mm-hmm. and like causing devastation on the ground level, like that's really compelling that there are like powers that be that we don't understand or know about and are like wreaking havoc and causing chaos and people don't know what they saw. You know, the sex workers think they saw a gun, but they didn't or whatever. It's like,
right.
There is some like post 9/11, like paranoia that could work really well in this movie. And it's just not there.
Absolutely.
Like the caller even says so. He's like, oh, like I could just shoot a gun right now. And he destroys the robot and nobody bats an eye. And it's like, this movie comes out the year after 9/11. I'm like, I'm pretty sure people would bat an eye.
Right. It premiered on the anniversary of 9/11. It premiered at Toronto on September 11th, 2002.
Oh my Lord.
And it was originally going to come out November of 2022. And then the Beltway snipers happened in October and they delayed it.
Oh my God. Was that the same year?
Same year.
I didn't even realize. Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
That is crazy. And also it is, I think it speaks to how poorly the film handles, again, the stakes and the tension that it could easily create, that an event like where this 9/11 paranoia happening and then the DC sniper attacks happen literally within a month of when it's supposed to be released. And that level of terror does not come through in the movie itself. I think part of that also, as the more I talk to you about it, I think a lot of that is reflective in we have a lead character who's supposed to be the person that we want to survive this situation, who is not a really rootable main character. We don't see, I feel like if this was a movie that was made in the 60s, we would have seen him be like a relatively upstanding guy. You know, he's probably going to show up. I don't know. He works for, let's just say he works for like a milk company and he's a family man. We'd probably see him hanging out with his family a little bit. And then you have some reasons to like the guy at first, you know, he's going to save the cat or pet the dog or whatever he's going to do. And then he shows up at the phone booth and you see the seedy side of him emerge. And then you're like, oh, this guy's got a problem. Uh-oh, but maybe he can redeem himself when the sniper comes around. In this movie, we only see Colin Farrell be a piece of shit and then be a scared piece of shit. And that's it.
Yeah, it's I'm predisposed to not like this guy. You know, like I see him with the swagger and the suit and he's fast talking to on his phone. Like I already don't like him very much. But in rewatching it, I'm like, oh, he's actually like he's getting his job done. He buys the whiskey for the newspaper writer who's sick. And he's like, you know, call it Irish chicken soup.
Irish,
you know,
chicken soup, yeah.
He is treating the intern. He's not paying him, but like a lot of interns are unpaid. So, you know, I don't really question that, especially for the early 2000s. Many are paid now. And he's like actually teaching him useful skills and like doing well for his client. Like you see him book the party, you see him like right. Do all these things. He is well-liked by the community. He's like shaking hands with people. I do see him as well-liked in that world, but we as the audience are like, I don't really like this guy. Like I wouldn't want to hang out with him.
Exactly.
You know? He's really not good or bad to me. And so I don't really know how to feel about the scenario once he's in there. I'm like, I guess, like, I don't desperately want him to survive, but yeah.
I don't really care if he dies either.
Yeah.
And I feel like, yeah, you hit the nail on the head. We are not really taught the way that in a movie like this, I feel like it is more necessary to make the audience feel a more overt way about your protagonist. And instead we just get a sweaty guy in a suit who is good at his job and not good to people. And then he makes it out
Speaking of not being good to people, which again, like, he's getting his job done, you know, as far as I can see, like, he's, I don't know, I don't see him as being bad to people, like, overtly, you know, in the, especially in the way of, like, the other victims of this caller.
Right.
But the caller, like, his worldview and his motivation is so inconsistent, and again, I think speaks to, like, the age of the writer, because he's like, oh, you're guilty of your inhumanity to your fellow man, and I just, like, you can hear me roll my eyes at that.
Yes.
So I'm like, okay, and he even says that the guy is, that Colin Farrell is small time, so I'm like, okay, why is he being targeted then? The why me is never answered, and then later he says, you're in this position because you're not telling the truth. So I'm like, so which is it? Is it because he's just, like, a liar, or because he's, like to his wife and to this girl, or is he just not a good person to everyone? Like, what is
also,
it?
Also, yeah, go after a bigger liar. Have this movie be set where you are going after, like, a Dick Cheney analog.
Make have it this movie bigger come stakes. Out in 2009. Make it a Wall Street bro. Make it, yeah, like, yeah, it just, there was so much ripe cultural critique that you could have had at this moment and just totally missed it.
There's some interesting stuff in the reviews of this movie. Obviously, this movie has somehow managed to get pretty solid reviews. And I'm reading through the Roger Ebert review. Roger. That's what the segment's going to be called now. Anytime I have a Roger Ebert review, I just go, oh, Roger. This is a sentence that came out of Roger Ebert's pen about the movie Phone Booth. If the movie had been conceived more recently, Stu would have been a hero for the way he lies and cheats.
Okay. I don't know if that's the case.
I don't know if that's the case totally either. True.
He
would have been a hero
for the way he lies and cheats. To some, maybe.
I guess. I mean, I feel like there's a difference.
There's a reason why, like, Entourage was so successful. Maybe, like, is, you know, I don't know when that started. It was, like, 2004, 2005 when that show starts.
Yeah,
like,
or Mad Men, too, right?
Yeah, maybe. But
that's the thing. Like, we watch those movies and we are not, or those TV shows, rather. I guess Entourage is technically a movie also. But we're watching those TV shows and we're watching those characters operate. And we still, to some degree, even after the initial glow wears off, where you're like, oh, look at this cool guy, look at him doing his thing and not caring, and then you were like, oh, that's why he's having all of these, like, personal problems. It's because he doesn't care. It's because he's bad. Actually, I'm so sorry to reveal to you that he's bad.
Yeah.
And now this, like, that's it. I feel like that's just, like, the lamest, faintest way of saying that you agree with Larry Cohen because you're the same fucking age, and that's it.
yeah. Talking about no stakes, like, as soon as Colin Farrell admits, like, what he's done, which he does twice in the movie, like, this movie should have been resolved halfway through, because he tells Kelly exactly what's been going on, and she's like, I don't care, it's fine, we'll work through it. I'm like, okay, well, there goes all of the dramatic tension. Wow.
The bad review that I found, thanks to Todd McCarthy, shout out Todd, is, it starts off right off the gate, and I think it's totally accurate. Even with a running time sans end credits of 74 minutes, there is scarcely enough material to pad out Phone Booth. Gussied up with a host of filmmaking tricks and an attempt to keep things lively, this intensely acted little exercise just doesn't have enough going for it, with the exception of the gradually growing interest in lead Colin Farrell to compel large numbers of people to spend first-run prices to see it.
Yeah, I mean, this was a huge breakout for him. He's on screen almost the entire time, and the material's not great, but I think he does a pretty good job with what he's given. Like, he sells it. I don't like sweaty, hair in the face, goateed Colin Farrell as much as I like him, you know, now, what he's doing, but he does his best. Definitely does his best here.
Is there a movie that you think people should watch instead of Phone Booth? What do you recommend for people who hate Phone Booth?
So it's funny that this comes out in 2002, and we already talked about like the post 9/11 of it all. And there is such a better movie that is set in the post 9/11 milieu of New York City, and it's 25th Hour, and it's just incredible. Have you seen 25th Hour?
I have not.
You must.
Then Spike Lee.
Spike Lee, Ed Norton, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Barry Pepper, Terrence Blanchard's score is all time. It's so good. I watched it again last night because another podcast, this had Oscar buzz, covered it on their show. And it's just so incredible. Yeah, definitely see that. And then Forrest Whitaker, the same year, stars in a better claustrophobic thriller set in New York City, Panic Room.
Yeah.
It's amazing that this year has just two, for what this Phone Booth is trying to do, 2002 has two better movies to offer.
There's a, you know, when I mentioned that Michael Bay was one of the people, I don't know actually if I did mention this, he was one of the people who was originally attached to direct or was interested in directing, they pitched
it
to him.
Not enough explosions. Not enough explosions.
That's literally, he said.
No helicopters at sunset.
In the first meeting, they say, he said, so how do we get this movie out of the phone booth? How fast can we get this out of the phone booth? And he's right.
Yeah.
This is, sorry, Larry. This is your old man yelling at cloud routine is not going to pan out here.
I do want to shout out a couple folks who did work on this movie who were like on the come up.
Shout us out. Shout out away.
Yeah. So the cinematographer was Matthew Libatique, who's later Oscar nominated for Black Swan and also worked on Inside Man, which if you want to see a better New York City hostage movie, that is like all set in one location, I guess. Like Inside Man. Have you never seen Inside Man either? Spike
never
Lee?
Never seen Inside Man.
Oh my God.
No, Inside Man is, is it? Wait, is that also Spike Lee?
It's also Spike Lee. And Terrence Blanchard does the score. He's done the score for like since Malcolm X.
I gotta see all these Spike Lee thrillers.
I have a lot of blind spots for Spike Lee. Like I finally watched Malcolm X during the pandemic, but holy shit, Inside Man and 25th Hour are two like top rewatchables for me. So, so good.
I'm gonna check it out.
And then Gil Netter produced this movie, later Oscar nominated for Life of Pi and The Blind Side. This was one of his first productions. And Daniel Orlandi, who did the costumes, goes on to work.
Yes.
Cinderella Man, Saving Mr. Banks, Jurassic World, Trumbo, The Blind Side, Frost Nixon, Logan, Ford v. Ferrari, like several Best Picture nominees in there. So lots of people on the come up, but then like Larry Cohen very much on the come down.
Yeah, Larry.
Because his next two movies... Captivity and Cellular both just like this was like the one where you're like, oh man, Larry Cohen gonna get a bunch of work because this made $100 million, and both of his next two movies just flat out bombed,
and then he just vanished. He cashed it.
Is he still alive? I don't want to speak ill of him. Is he still dead?
He came up with one other movie. He did write one other movie called Messages Deleted, which is a 2009 Canadian horror film. A screenwriting teacher is forced to live out of the plot of a screenplay idea he stole from an anonymous character who now seeks revenge.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like he's just rehashing Phone Booth, but with text
his
messages.
Like, with also like literally him as the insert, I guess it sounds like.
Yeah.
I feel like he might have been teaching screenwriting.
And Matthew Lillard plays him.
Oh, I do like Matthew Lillard, though.
I would go watch this movie just to see Matthew Lillard's take on playing Larry Cohen.
No, your movie watching assignments are 25th Hour and Inside Man.
Fair. I will watch those instead. And I will.
Well, I guess you have to watch Run first, but yeah.
Yes, but I will gladly watch some Spike Lee after the fact. Ben, it is a pleasure having you back on. Of course, you are no stranger to plugging things. You already plugged American Scene, which people should go listen to, even though it's on hiatus. Go get back in there.
Yeah, since we started the podcast, although it has been on hiatus, like I want to say 10 to 15 movies have come out with American in the title. So we've got our work cut out for us. There's Janusz Kaminski directed a movie called American Dream that came out with very poor reviews. But that's just one of them. American Underdog, what's that football story?
Oh yeah, with Zachary Levi. Yeah. That actually is secretly a Christian movie.
Oh, not secretly.
Yeah, it's pretty overtly. it's pretty overt if you watch the trailers.
Yeah. So that'll be fun once we get back into that. And then, I mean, anybody wants to follow me on Twitter at not that Ben Rosen is just kind of, I don't really tweet about anything, but it's fun.
By the way, and I've mentioned this at the very top of the episode, of course. Sorry. Conserve energy now to protect public health and safety. I just got an emergency alert on my phone. So, sorry. I'm going to keep recording. Take that, California. I know we're in a heat wave. I've got my fan blowing on me. The thing I was going to say, besides plugging all of Blockbusting, which is at Blockbusting Pod on all the social media platforms that you desire, I said at the beginning of the show, and I'm going to say it again now, we got a Patreon. You should subscribe to it. Shout out to our two new subscribers this week. I shouted you out personally on the Patreon bonus episode for the week. But if we get more subscribers on Patreon, then guess what? Ben doesn't have to keep doing the producing part of this podcast out of the kindness of his heart. I can finally start paying him. So give me your patronage so I can give Ben a few bucks for making phone calls and scheduling and being a delight to work with.
It's a pleasure working with you too.
And of course you can find me at Diajane, all the platforms, but dude, Patreon, that's the more important thing. All right. This is what we have because, because he's right here in front of you. Appeal to something. There's some sort of an appeal that if I was fresher in my debate class tactics, I would remember what this is called.
Was it ethos? Pathos? I think it's pathos. Yeah, the emotional appeal. Yeah.
Yeah, emotional appeal, which Phone Booth has none of. Anyway, full circle. Ben, thanks again for coming back.
Glad to be here.
This has been Blockbusting. Go see something good for a change.